Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
The red started rising at my neck again. I prepared to make a witty retort, but had been masterfully diverted from my previous train of thought. Florrie knew which buttons to push and had pushed all of mine in great style. How do you know about the parentage of Axel's children? Florrie's eyes twinkled. Honey, when I moved to this frozen hellhole from Georgia, Axel was the only person who'd give a black girl a job. I suspected that he thought he could bully me into being his personal servant, but he didn't know me very well, and he greatly underestimated my moral character and my willingness to tell all I knew to interested parties, like his wife. What did he hire you to do? I was a waitress at his bar down in Mattawa for a while, and then I managed his restaurant out on Fish Lake, west of Duluth, for a few years. That's quite a step up, moving from waitress to restaurant manager. You must have been very good. Of course I was very good, and I kept very good notes. I saw who was coming and going at the bar, and which guys were leaving with other people's wives. A few of them tried to hit on me, but I am quite capable of setting boundaries and defending them. After a while they gave up, and then, when I'd drop a name or two, or ask where the previous night's conquest was, they caught on to the fact that I was paying too much attention to what was going on, and that they'd best stay on my good side for the sake of their marriages. So you know where the skeletons are buried, I summarized, and Axel moved you to Fish Lake to minimize the risk. I'd like to think that he saw how much more money he was making on the nights when I filled in as bartender, and saw how much calmer the crowd was when I worked, and decided that he needed someone to clean up the Fish Lake restaurant before it went bankrupt. Did you turn it around? Florrie laughed. I did, and it started making money. People started coming in because the food was good, and I poured a fair drink. Pretty soon it became a cash cow, and Axel was making a mint off of it. I sense there is a catch here. The restaurant went from bankrupt to wealthy, and Axel seized the opportunity to sell it while he could show a buyer a great set of books. What happened to you, Florrie? The new owner put his daughter in as the new manager and hired her worthless, drug-dealing husband as the cook. I got fired. Axel didn't hire you back at the bar? Oh, hell no. Like you said, I knew where too many skeletons were hidden, and he saw that as a liability. I knew too much, and he was too pleased that he'd stuck it to me. I think he was hoping I'd catch a bus back to Georgia. Why didn't you? You called this place a frozen hellhole. Why not go back? Florrie's face clouded. Some skeletons are scarier than others. Her face brightened, and she added, and I met a nice guy who thought a curvy, dark-skinned girl with a sense of humor was a pretty good companion. I guess I've never asked about your family. Do you have any children? I never married, and I wasn't about to raise a bastard child by myself. I just kept looking for Mr. Wright and made the most of the ones who were wrong while they were around. How about you, Peter? When are you going to make an honest woman of that skinny little girl? She thinks the world of you. I can see it in her eyes. Again, I felt the red creep up my neck. You're what? You're scared? You're taking advantage of a good thing. You're not buying a cow when the milk is free. What? Her face was mirthful, but the words were pointed. Honey, you've got to get serious, or turn that girl loose to find someone who will spend the rest of his life with her. Once again, Florrie had turned the conversation in another direction, and I tried to steer it back again. How did you end up here at Whistling Pines? A girl doesn't live on love alone, she said, laughing at her own joke. I get to socialize here, and the clientele are a lot better than the folks I was hanging around with at the bars. How did it go with Axel showing up as a resident? Florrie nodded her head. He didn't care if I was here or not. As far as he was concerned, the world revolved around him, and all the rest of us were just pawns he used to get to the top of the heap. He must have known that you were unhappy about getting fired at the restaurant. Oh, he knew that, honey. He was aware of my unhappiness because I told him in the most basic words I could find. You know what he did when I reamed him? He laughed. He leaned back in his old office chair and he laughed at me. He called me a stupid bitch and told me to get out before he called the cops. Did you hate him enough to kill him? Florrie closed her eyes like she was replaying an old scene in her head. Back then, if I'd had a gun, I'd have shot him. But you know what? He wasn't worth it. Besides, I got even, and the best part is that he never knew how. What fun is revenge if you don't see the target suffer? I asked. His wife got some pictures in the mail that opened her eyes to some things that were going on. I'm pretty sure that his life went into the toilet for a while because of me. I saw him suffer and squirm. He just never knew that it was me who was making the waves that he was rowing against. But I thought his wife was a beaten woman who went along with anything Axel wanted. Oh, that's what Axel wanted people to think. In reality, Enid was a cunning fox who had him by the short hairs. Let me tell you what she did. Florrie leaned close. They had a daughter, but she knew that he wanted a son to carry on the business and family name. Well, when she found out that he was sleeping around while she was pregnant, she went and got an abortion, and he lost the only son he might have ever had. How could you know something like that? Axel got the mumps after the abortion, and they went down on him. The doctors said his little swimmers were all dead, and that he would be shooting blanks the rest of his life. His wife had the two boys afterward, and Axel was too vain to admit that he couldn't be their biological father. That's pretty heavy revenge, I said, thinking about the family dynamics and considering how much of the dysfunction might be explained if the family knew about all these skeletons. Peter, I'm going to tell you something very important. She took my hand in hers and looked deeply into my eyes. There is nothing more going on than you know about. Do you understand what I'm saying? Not really, I replied. I thought Axel's death had something to do with Whistling Pines. Honey, I think Axel's death is related to things that were set in motion long before Axel came here. Florrie released my hand and stood up. Now get out of here and pretend we never had this conversation. As she walked away, I pondered her words. Obviously, she knew more than she'd said. Was she trying to throw me a red herring to get me off the track? Florrie made it sound as if Axel had suffered plenty when she'd extracted her revenge, and I had the impression that she had little remaining motive to murder him. Whistling Pines, Chapter 24. I headed back to my office, wondering what had just happened. My mind drifted back to the conversation that Jenny and I had with my neighbor Dolores and her tales of intrigue and people close to Axel being killed or disappearing. I was so deep in my thoughts that I didn't hear Len walk up behind me until he cleared his throat. "Geez, Len, do you have to sneak up on me like that?" "No sneaking involved, Peter," Len said as he fumbled with the pipe he'd fished from his breast pocket. "You weren't paying attention." He took out a chrome-plated tool and fiddled with the tobacco before putting the pipe between his lips. He pulled out a lighter and was about to fire up when I stopped him. "You can't smoke inside, Len." "I know," he said, making the pipe bob with each syllable. "That doesn't mean I can't get the oral pleasure of having it in my lips. You know, they say that 60% of the addiction is the smoking ritual and the oral pleasure of stuffing something between your lips." "That sounds a little kinky, if you ask me." "There's nothing sexual about it. As a matter of fact, people claim that it's more of a return to nursing like a baby." Either way, it seemed like something that you should step away from. I'll make you a deal, Peter. You find the killer, and I'll quit smoking again. Until then, leave me to my vices and tell me what you've heard. Flory Stevens used to work for Axel, and she said that there are a lot of skeletons buried. Len gave up the search for his lighter and put the pipe back between his lips as he pushed papers aside to sit in my guest chair. Now that's a name that hasn't been on my radar before. I mean, I know who Flory is, but I've never had any reason to interact with her, which usually means that she's an upstanding citizen, or at least someone who spends her evenings at home, not making noise with the folks who hang out at the bars. Where did you run into Flory? She works the early shift in the kitchen here, and I was setting breakfast tables. We talked over a cup of coffee for a few minutes. She told me something else. Axel's two sons are not biologically his. She claims that his wife had them after he was no longer able to father a child. Len froze. Say that again. Axel caught the mumps after his daughter was born, and it did something to his testicles. When his wife learned about his philandering, she got even with him in a way that he couldn't protest publicly. If he told anyone that he couldn't be the father of the boys, then everyone would know that he wasn't the stud that he claimed to be. Wow, that sure puts a crimp in the theory that the killer was one of the women that he'd scorned here. What women had he scorned here? The question came from Jenny, who had apparently been listening outside the door. Good morning. One of our theories was that Axel had been having an affair with one of the women here and that she killed him after he dumped her, I explained. First of all, Jenny said firmly, the theory shouldn't contain the possessive pronoun our, because you, Peter, are not investigating this crime. Secondly, there was no affair and hence no scorned woman. Thirdly, being impotent is not a barrier to sexual intimacy since the invention of the penile implant and more recently Viagra. You knew that Axel was sterile? Len asked. That's immaterial. Most men his age suffer from either erectile dysfunction or low libido. The age of modern pharmaceuticals has made that irrelevant, and a little blue pill can do wonders for nearly anyone. Well, anyone it doesn't kill because of their blood pressure drops. But, Len pointed his unlit pipe at Jenny, the BCA didn't find any blue pills in the search of his apartment. There are HIPAA rules about patient privacy, Jenny replied. The patient is dead, Jenny, Len reminded her. The only one who cares if Axel was using blue pills is me, and I only care because it affects my pool of potential murder suspects. I'd like to know about his partners. Well, then, I guess I'd better tell you before you tie me to a chair and turn a hot light on my head. Oh, Wendy said from somewhere outside the office door, I love it when you talk dirty like you're having phone sex. Does this involve handcuffs, too? Darn it, Wendy, Jenny cursed as the color rose in her cheeks. Why does everything have to be sexual with you? Wendy crowded into the office with the three of us, which left none of us with any personal space. Having been inside Humvees rolled by roadside IEDs in Iraq, I often feel a little claustrophobic in my cubbyhole office. The fourth person in the tiny space was too much for me to handle. All right, I said, rising from my chair. Everyone, get out of my office. I need some air. But I heard all the talk about the blue pills and the hot lights, Wendy said, as we all retreated into the lobby. I didn't know you had a cop in there with you, and, Peter, I just came down to tell you that the Canadian bagpiper called me and her minivan broke down somewhere outside Kenora. What Canadian bagpiper? I haven't contacted any bagpipers, much less any from Canada. I was almost shouting. Sure you have, Wendy said as she swept past me and fell into my desk chair. Her hands manipulated the computer mouse, and within seconds my nightmare was being replayed to the tune of Loch Lomond. There, on the screen, was the topless blonde playing plaid bagpipes and bouncing merrily as she belted out the tune. See? As quickly as she appeared, the piper was gone and my electronic inbox opened. Wendy quickly clicked open an email and read it aloud. Dear Peter, I'm responding to confirm your earlier email. I am happy to drive to Two Harbors, Minnesota, to play the pipes for a funeral. I understand the family's wishes and your frustration in not finding a local piper, so I agree to waive my usual fee as long as you pay for my mileage and for two nights at the Holiday Inn next to the Mall of America. She signed it, Laura Good. Jenny was drilling holes in my head with her glare, and Len was suppressing a laugh, but it finally broke through as a raspy, coughing fit. Wendy jumped from my chair and stepped behind Len, wrapping her arms around him like a bear hug and doing a Heimlich maneuver on him while he waved his pipe in the air. I knew that you shouldn't do a Heimlich on someone who was breathing, but Jenny grabbed my arm before I could intervene. How could you order a stripper for Axel's funeral? Jenny asked, almost seething. I didn't. Someone is using my email account. Besides, her email doesn't say anything about stripping. It only says that she's coming to play the pipes. How naive do you think I am, Peter? Did you look at her website? Jenny rolled her eyes. Of course you looked at her website. Why else would it be among the internet favorite websites on your computer? What's the matter with you? I pulled free of Jenny's grasp and grabbed Wendy before she could Heimlich Len a third time. Len was turning purple from lack of air, and I was afraid Wendy might have broken a couple of Len's ribs. Len bent over and drew a couple of deep breaths as we all waited silently, and then he started laughing. This is not funny, Jenny said. By the time he straightened up, tears were streaming down his face. Oh, Jenny, if you could have seen your face when that girl popped up on the computer screen, you'd be laughing too. He reached out and gave her a fatherly hug. Next, he turned to Wendy. Since you seem to be the one with Peter's computer password, would you care to tell us when you asked the stripper to drive down for the funeral? Peter never turns his computer off, and he hasn't been using a password, Wendy countered. It could have been anyone. It could have been, but it wasn't anyone. It was you, correct? Len asked. Wendy looked at her shoes. I suppose it could have been me, but there are other suspects you'll probably want to question. Did you give Peter's credit card out, too? No way, Wendy protested. I'm sure he'd used it on some website that wasn't secure, and it was scooped up by an internet bot or someone who was phishing his computer. You're paying for a hooker to rent a motel at the Mall of America? Jenny asked Wendy. It's every girl's dream shopping location, Wendy said. People fly from all over, even Japan, for a weekend of shopping there. When we were negotiating, I suggested it, and Laura jumped right on it, offering to do the funeral for nothing if we paid for her mileage and motel. I find that hard to believe, Jenny said. Well, she did mention that there's a convention in Minneapolis and that she might be able to earn a little spending money. I think she meant that she was going to put out a tam o' shanter and play her bagpipes in one of the skyways downtown by the convention center. I hate to say this, Len said, stuffing the pipe back in his pocket, but I'm a cop and I didn't hear that you arranged for a Canadian prostitute to drive to Minneapolis during a convention weekend so she could earn money to spend at the Mall of America. Wendy looked anything but contrite. She told Peter, or Peter's email, that she'd even show him what pipers wear under their kilts. The million candle power glare was back, and I felt a pinch on my bicep. That's one question that will remain a mystery to Peter, Jenny said. Ouch, I wasn't the one who asked. Why am I getting pinched? I yelped. Whistling Pines, Chapter 25. Miriam walked toward us, wearing her food-stained apron, and asked, "Has anyone seen Florrie? She was setting tables, but no one has seen her for like 15 minutes. I pulled Len with me as I ran for the dining room's back door, the last place I'd seen Florrie when I left the dining room. "Florrie implied that she could be in danger by sharing information about Axel," I said over my shoulder as we jogged across the dining room. "I wonder if someone overheard us talking." The dining room opened onto a patio that overlooked a huge lawn, leading to the cliffs above the town and a spectacular view of Lake Superior. A weather front had moved through, and the warm, damp air had dumped rain overnight. The cool ground caused eerie wisps of fog to form. Across the lawn was a stand of huge Norway pines that formed the north border of the grounds. Beyond the pines was a copse of poplar trees. I saw a bluish glow that looked like an LED flashlight, and I took off running. I could hear Len start out close behind me, but he quickly faded, unable to keep up with my sprint. In the morning twilight, trees loomed in front of me, and the faint light darted in and out of the trees. I dodged trees and rocks. Underbrush ripped at my pants. In my headlong dash to follow the light, I was completely blindsided by the blow that left me with a floating sensation before I fell to the ground. My next recollection was chattering voices, stars spinning before my eyes, and a wave of nausea that forced me to purge the contents of my stomach onto my chest. I closed my eyes only to have an eyelid lifted and a blinding light flashed in and out of my eye. "Peter, can you hear me?" Jenny asked. "Get the light out of my eyes," I said, pushing the flashlight aside. I blinked my eyes a few times, but everything was blurry and had a rosy cast. "I was following a flashlight. Did you see the light?" "What light, Peter?" Jenny asked. "There was a light in the trees. Someone was running with a light." "Peter," this time I heard Len's voice, "I found some rabbit snares set among the pines and some small footprints. I think one of the neighbor kids was checking his trap line, and you probably saw his flashlight." "Did he hit me with a baseball bat?" "Actually, it looks like you ran headlong into a low pine branch," Len replied. "I was running after you, yelling for you to stop, and then you looked like something out of a Roadrunner cartoon. You hit the branch so hard that your feet lifted right off the ground." The nausea eased enough to let the searing pain in my forehead leak through, and suddenly I felt like I'd been hit by, well, a tree. "Where's Florrie?" "She was taking a smoke break behind the dumpster," Jenny said. I tried to push myself up to a sitting position, but was met with physical restraint from Jenny and another wave of nausea. This time I turned my head and retched into the pine needle duff under the huge Norway pine that had clocked me. The wind moaned through the pine branches, giving me a sudden chill. I felt Jenny dabbing at my forehead, and each dab felt like I was being stabbed. "Will you stop it? That hurts." "Sorry," Jenny said. "I was trying to mop up some of the blood. You were bleeding like a proverbial stuck pig for a while. I think you should go to the emergency room for a few stitches." "I've had worse headbangs than this. Just let me get back to my office," I said as I pushed myself from the ground. "I'll be fine if I sit for a while." That said, my world started moving and I had to grab Len's arm to stay upright. It was embarrassing to have a herd of people helping me through the dining room door as the early bird residents were shuffling in for breakfast. Every head turned to look at me, and Howard Johnson stopped a few feet short of our group. "Jenny," Howard said, "what in hell happened to Peter?" "He had a little run-in with a low-hanging branch," she replied.
You've been listening to Episode 12. Of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org under the Programs tab near the top of the home page. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.